Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the National Weather Service inside it. It never occurred to him to put Barry Meyer's name on it. I don't want someone who has a bottom line or a concern with shareholders in charge of saving lives and protecting property, he said. But it was more than that. To put Barry Meyer's in charge of NOAA was to give him control over maybe the most valuable and necessary pile of data that the U.S. government collects. The more people have access to the weather data, the better it is for the country, said the Bush official. There's so much gold in there, people just don't know how to get to it. D.J. Patil had gone to Washington in 2014 to help people find that gold. He was the human expression of an executive order Obama had signed the year before, insisting that all unclassified government data be made publicly available and that it be machine-readable. DJ assumed he'd need to leave when the man who hired him left office, so that gave him just 2 years. We did not have time to collect new data, he said. We were just trying to open up what we had. He set out to make as many connections as possible between the information and the people who could make new sense of it, to encourage them to use the data in novel and interesting ways. I was looking to find people like me when I was a student, he said. We're going to open all the data and go to every economics department and say, hey, you want a PhD? In every agency, there were questions to be answered. Most of the answers we have gotten have not come from government. They've come from the broad American public who has access to the data. The opioid crisis was a case in point. The data scientists in the Department of Health and Human Services had opened up the Medicaid and Medicare data, which held information about prescription drugs. Journalists at ProPublica had combed through it and discovered odd concentrations of opioid prescriptions. We would never have figured out that there was an opioid crisis without the data, said DJ. The big pools of raw facts accumulated by the federal government are windows into American life. A team of researchers at Stanford University, led by an economist named Raj Chetty, used newly accessible data from the Internal Revenue Service to write a series of papers that addressed questions of opportunity in American life. One, titled The Fading American Dream, asked a simple question: how likely is it that an American child will be better off than his parents? The IRS data allowed Chetty to study Americans across generations, and the census data let him compare them by race, gender, or whichever trait he wished to isolate. In the data, he found an answer to his question, and much more. He discovered that while just over 90% of children born in 1940 went on to earn more than their parents, only 50% of children born in the 1980s did so. Every year, the economic future of an American child was a bit less bright. And the big reason was not lower rates of economic growth, but the increasing unequal distribution of money. More and more of the gains were being captured by the very rich. Mobility had a racial dimension as well. A white child born into the upper income quintile was 5 times more likely to stay there than to fall to the bottom. A black child born into the upper income quintile was as likely to fall to the bottom as to remain rich. More of America's problems than even DJ had imagined could be better understood and addressed with better access to the right information. The problem of excessive police force was another example. After a white policeman shot a defenseless black man in Ferguson, Missouri, the White House convened police chiefs from 10 American cities along with their data. The policing data was local and difficult to get hold of, and that was DJ's point. He wanted to show what might be possible if the government collected the information. We asked the question, what causes excessive use of police force? Combing the data from the 10 cities, a team of researchers from several American universities found a pattern that would have been hard to spot with the naked eye. Police officers who had just come from an emotionally fraught situation, a suicide or a domestic abuse call in which a child was involved, were more likely to use excessive force. Maybe the problem wasn't as simple as a bad cop. Maybe it was the emotional state in which the cop had found himself. Dispatch sent them right back out without time to decompress, said DJ. Give them a break in between and maybe they behave differently. A young guy in the White House pulled up stop and search rates from another pile of policing data. He discovered that a black person in a car was no more likely to be pulled over by the police than a white person. The difference was what happened next. If you're black, you're way more likely to get searched, said DJ. But then he noticed another pattern. Not all the cops exhibited the same degree of racial bias. A few cops in one southern city were 10 times more likely than others to search a black person they had pulled over. Right there in the White House, the young researcher showed the data to the city's police chief. He genuinely had no idea, said DJ. He was like, "Can you please tell me more?" In the end, even DJ Patil was shocked by the possibilities that lurked in the raw piles of information the government had acquired. "I didn't grasp the scope at first," he said. "And if you wanted to see the possibilities, the value that the entire society might reap from letting smart people loose on the data, you needed to look no further than David Friedberg." In 2006, Friedberg was driving home in the rain to San Francisco from his job in Mountain View when he noticed how differently people behaved when it rained. The weather affected all sorts of businesses, though not so much Google, where Friedberg worked. The specific business that had caught Friedberg's eye was a bike rental company near Bayside Village on the Embarcadero. When it rained, no one rented bikes. Obviously. Friedberg had graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, 5 years earlier, with a degree in astrophysics. He was 27 years old, but could pass for 16. Because of where he lived and who he worked for, it was second nature for him to think, "If I can get my hands on data and quantify weather risk, I can sell weather insurance to the businesses that need it. Ski resorts, airlines, utility companies, golf courses, packagers of beach vacations. There was really no end of industries or even governments that he might serve. Every inch of snow cost the city of New York $1.8 million. He found a few friends and angel investors to back him and hired a group of mathematicians to collect and analyze weather data. "Math people figure shit out," he said. His math people soon discovered the rich haul of weather data inside the Department of Commerce. They asked for and received the historical rainfall and temperature data from the National Weather Service's 200 weather stations. They discovered that NOAA had collected, for the previous 40 years, rainfall and temperature at every American airport, however small. They learned that NOAA maintained 158 radar installations and that these recorded a big percentage of the rain that had fallen in America during the past 50 years, along with anything else that happened to be in the air. That's how the United States government had found the pieces of the Columbia after the space shuttle exploded in midair, using NOAA's radar. The federal government has the sort of data on the weather that the Boston Red Sox has on Major League Baseball players. But unlike the Red Sox, it had made little effort to exploit the value in it. The images from the radar stations, for instance. They were on tapes in a basement of a NOAA office in Asheville, North Carolina. To get the data into a form he could use, Friedberg paid NOAA to put it on hard drives and ship them to him. He then moved the data for free to the cloud. "That was the first data set we were able to get onto the cloud," said Ed Kearns, chief data officer at NOAA. David showed Google and Amazon and Microsoft that there was a business case for taking it. Until we got it up, no one was able to reprocess the data. Of course, without cloud computing, there would have been no place to put the radar data. But once it was on the cloud, it was generally accessible and could be used for any purpose. Ornithologists at Cornell University would soon be using it to study bird migrations. The math team at Friedberg's new company, which he called WeatherBill, used it to calculate the weather odds for some very specific situations. "What is risk?" asked Friedberg. "Risk is uncertainty about the outcome. The less data you have, the more uncertainty you have about the outcome. If you are the first person to cross the ocean on a ship, you are going to have trouble insuring yourself. If you are the 1,000th ship, there is now data that certain kinds of ships do better than others. Certain times of year are more treacherous than others. Certain kinds of hulls are more durable, and so forth. The more data we captured, the more we were able to determine the probabilities of some unfortunate event occurring," said Friedberg. But there were private companies like AccuWeather and the Weather Company that had issues with us getting access to weather data. In the end, we agreed, with NOAA, we would not have access to the weather data today. We just get the historical data. It took 18 months before WeatherBill had a website on which anyone could come and insure himself against the weather. And people did turn up in fits and spurts. The U.S. Open tennis tournament bought rain insurance, for example, as did the broadcaster that aired the matches. Anything more than 0.01 inches of rain per hour means they can't play that hour, said Friedberg. Other interested parties included an Arizona ski resort, a pair of golf courses, a beach resort in Barbados, a car wash, and a hummus shop called Hummus Brothers. Friedberg hadn't known that people bought less hummus when it rained, but then he was learning all sorts of odd stuff about people's exposure to the weather. Salad places did much better on sunny days. Coffee shops did not. But Friedberg also learned that it was harder to sell weather insurance than he had supposed. He had this quaint supposition that there were all of these people looking for this online, says one of his former business partners, and they weren't. By 2008, Friedberg realized that if he wanted to meet the people who needed weather insurance, he'd have to hit the road and find them. That's when he stumbled on the California citrus packers. The year before, in 2007, there'd been a bad freeze. The citrus farmers were able to obtain some insurance through the federal government, but the companies that packed and shipped the fruit were not. If the temperature goes below 28 degrees for 4 hours or more, they have no business, said Friedberg. The California citrus packers had learned that the hard way. Then we started talking to the growers, said Friedberg, and they weren't fully covered either, and we thought, if this is just citrus, agriculture must be big. That was the turning point for David Friedberg. He realized that the people most exposed to the weather and most receptive to insuring themselves against it were farmers. The Farmer's Almanac had offered them weather predictions for the growing season since 1792, but those predictions had never been any better than guessing. The U.S. Department of Agriculture offered insurance against catastrophic crop loss, but still left farmers with lots of exposure. There was a need. There was also a problem. To evaluate the weather risk to any one farmer's crop, Friedberg would need to predict not just the weather, but how any given field responded to it. What kind of soil did it have? How well did it retain water? The question became, where might he find this kind of data? Once again, the U.S. government had it. NOAA had 40 years worth of infrared satellite images of all the land in the United States, again on tape drives in some basement. Plants absorb visible light and emit infrared light. You could calculate the biomass in a field by how much infrared light it emitted. Friedberg brokered a deal with Google, which had digitized the information and gave him access to it for free. That's when we discovered that farmers were lying about the dates they were planting, said Friedberg. The Federal Crop Insurance Program, seeking to minimize the risk of freeze, stipulated the earliest date that a farmer was allowed to plant. But the earlier the seeds went into the ground, the richer the crop. To qualify for the insurance, farmers had been claiming to have planted their seeds later than they had. The lie had been captured for decades by satellite, but no one had been able to see the data. Inside the Department of Agriculture, Friedberg's math team found data on the size and shape of every one of America's 26 million fields. Inside the Department of the Interior, they found data on the soil composition of those fields. They said, "No one has ever asked us for this," said Friedberg. That one database was so big that it couldn't be transmitted over the Internet. He'd had to pay the government agency to send it on hard drives, which he then sent to engineers at Amazon, who moved it all to the cloud. In each of the 6 years from 2007 to 2013, Friedberg's company used 40 times more data than the year before. All this data, it would never have existed if not for the government infrastructure that collected it, said Friedberg. There's no private institution that on their own would have collected it, and without it, we couldn't have made predictions. We would never have had a business without that data. But by the time we were done, we could really quantify the effects of weather on farming. In 2011, Friedberg decided to sell exclusively to farmers, and Weatherbill changed its name to the Climate Corporation. We needed to feel a little less Silicon Valley and less whimsical, said Friedberg. For the next few years, he would spend half his time on the road, explaining himself to people whose first step was toward mistrust. Farmers don't believe anything, he said. There's always been some bullshit product for farmers, and the people selling it are usually from out of town. He'd sit down in some barn or wood shop, pull out his iPad, and open up a map of whatever Corn Belt state he happened to be in. He'd let the farmer click on his field. up pop the odds of various unpleasant weather events, a freeze, a drought, a hailstorm, and his crop's sensitivity to them. He'd show the farmer how much money he would have made in each of the previous 30 years if he had bought weather insurance. Then David Friedberg, Silicon Valley kid, would teach the farmer about his own fields. He'd show the farmer exactly how much moisture the field contained at any given moment. Above a certain level, the field would be damaged if worked on. He'd show him the rainfall and temperature every day, which you might think the farmer would know, but then the farmer might be managing 20 or 30 different fields spread over several counties. He'd show the farmer the precise stage of growth of his crop, the best moments to fertilize, the optimum 8-day window to plant his seeds, and the ideal harvest date. The fertilizer was a big deal to them. "The biggest expense farmers have is fertilizer," said Friedberg. "They'll spend $100 an acre on corn seed and $200 on fertilizer, and their net profit might be $100 an acre. If it rains right after you fertilize, the fertilizer washes away. So how do you decide when to plant and when to fertilize? I had guys come up to me after and say, 'You saved me $400,000 last year.'" Farming had always involved judgment calls that turned on the instincts of the farmer. The Climate Corporation had turned farming into decision science and a matter of probabilities. The farmer was no longer playing roulette but blackjack, and David Friedberg was helping him to count the cards. For a lot of these guys, it was like, "My mind is blown," Friedberg recalled. They didn't believe that the knowledge could be created. All the new technology they had ever seen in their lives was physical. New machines, new seeds, new kinds of fertilizer. All these had just been tools for the farmer to use. None of them had replaced the farmer. No one ever asked Friedberg the question, "If my knowledge is no longer useful, who needs me?" But it was a good question. "There is stuff the farmer picks up on that we haven't got data on yet," he said. "For example, are there bugs in the field? But over time, that'll go to zero. Everything will be observed. Everything will be predicted." About a year after they started selling insurance to farmers, the people at the Climate Corporation noticed something funny was going on. The farmers buying their weather insurance were spending a lot of time playing with the software to which the insurance gave them access. "We found the farmers logging in just to see the data on their fields," said Friedberg. To insure American farmers, he'd needed to understand the fields better than the farmers did themselves. Now they knew it. "We thought we were in the insurance business, but we were actually in the knowledge business," said Friedberg. It went from being insurance to being recommendations for farmers. That first year, in 2011, the Climate Corporation generated $60 million in sales just from selling weather insurance to farmers. 3 years later, they were insuring 150 million acres of American farmland, the bulk of the Corn Belt, and teaching the farmers how to farm them more efficiently. 6 years after venture capitalists valued David Friedberg's new company at $6 million, Monsanto bought it for $1.1 billion. And yet through the entire experience, David Friedberg had this growing sense of unease. "When you come from San Francisco and grew up in Silicon Valley, every measure is about progress," he said. "The progress in society, the progress in the economy, the progress of technology. And you kind of get used to that. And you think that's the norm in the way the world operates, because you see everything getting better. Then you get on a plane, and if you land anywhere but a big city, it feels the same. It's total stagnation. It's, 'We've been farming the same 6 fields for the last 70 years. It's getting married at 19 or 20. It's the opposite of progression. Life is about keeping up. Life is about keeping everything the same." People in the places he traveled lived from paycheck to paycheck. They were exposed to risks in ways that he was not. The weather was just one of those risks. He began to notice other kinds of data. For instance, that 40% of Americans can't cover an unexpected expense of $1,000. The farmers usually weren't so bad off, but their situation was inherently precarious and threatened by modernity. Farmers didn't work on desktop computers, and so they'd largely skipped the initial internet revolution. But they had mobile phones, and in 2008, when the 3G networks went up in rural America, farmers finally got online. "The problem with the internet is that it shows everyone on Earth what they're missing," said Friedberg. "And if you can't get to it, you feel you were getting fucked, that there is this very visceral and obvious shift that is happening in the world that you're missing out on." At the same time David Friedberg was helping farmers to secure their immediate economic future, he was threatening their identity. Your family has been tilling this same soil for a century, and yet this data-crunching machine I've built in just a few years can do it better. The phrase was a whisper underlying every conversation he'd had with a farmer. Friedberg played in a high-stakes poker game with some friends in the tech world. In their last game before the 2016 presidential election, he offered to bet anyone who would take the other side that Donald Trump would win. After Trump took office, DJ Patil watched with wonder as the data disappeared across the federal government. Both the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of the Interior removed from their websites the links to climate change data. The USDA removed the inspection reports of businesses accused of animal abuse by the government. The new acting head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mick Mulvaney, said he wanted to end public access to records of consumer complaints against financial institutions. 2 weeks after Hurricane Maria, statistics that detailed access to drinking water and electricity in Puerto Rico were deleted from the FEMA website. In a piece for 538, Claire Malone and Jeff Asher pointed out that the first annual crime report released by the FBI under Trump was missing nearly three-quarters of the data tables from the previous year. Among the data missing from the 2016 report is information on arrests, the circumstances of homicides, such as the relationships between victims and perpetrators, and the only national estimate of annual gang murders, they wrote. Trump said he wanted to focus on violent crime and yet was removing the most powerful tool for understanding it. And as for the country's first chief data scientist, well, the Trump administration did not show the slightest interest in him. I basically knew that these guys weren't going to listen to us, said DJ. So we created these exit memos. The memos show that this stuff pays for itself 1,000 times over. He hoped the memos might give the incoming administration a sense of just how much was left to be discovered in the information the government had collected. There were questions crying out for answers. For instance, what was causing the boom in traffic fatalities? The Department of Transportation had giant pools of data waiting to be searched. 100 Americans were dying every day in car crashes. The 30-year trend of declining traffic deaths has reversed itself dramatically. We don't really know what's going on, said DJ. Distracted driving? Heavier cars? Faster driving? More driving? Bike lanes? The knowledge to be discovered in government data might shift the odds in much of American life. You could study the vaccination data, for instance, and create heat maps for disease. If you could randomly drop someone with measles somewhere in the United States, where would you have the biggest risk of an epidemic? Said DJ. Where are epidemics waiting to happen? These questions, when you have access to data, you can do things. Everyone is focused on how data is a weapon. Actually, if we don't have data, we're screwed. His memos were never read, DJ suspects. At any rate, he's never heard a peep about them. And he came to see there was nothing arbitrary or capricious about the Trump administration's attitude toward public data. Under each act of data suppression usually lay a narrow commercial motive. A gun lobbyist, a coal company, a poultry company. The NOAA webpage used to have a link to weather forecasts, he said. It was highly, highly popular. I saw it had been buried, and I asked, now why would they bury that? Then he realized. The man Trump nominated to run NOAA thought that people who wanted a weather forecast should have to pay him for it. There was a rift in American life that was now coursing through American government. It wasn't between Democrats and Republicans. It was between the people who are in it for the mission and the people who are in it for the money. The first time DJ Patil met Kathy Sullivan, he'd gone to talk to her about how she might better use data. He wound up learning from her how he might better approach his new mission. She said something very insightful. She said, working for the government, you need to imagine you are tied down Gulliver style. And if you want to even wiggle your big toe, first you need to ask permission. And that if you can imagine that and still imagine getting things done, you'll get things done. The single most important source of data for the weather models are the satellites. The geostationary satellites hover over the equator, taking pictures of whatever is happening beneath them. The polar satellites circle the globe from North Pole to South Pole and gather data from the entire planet. They take soundings of the temperature and moisture in the atmosphere, measure vegetation coverage, monitor ozone levels, detect hot spots, and so are able to report fires before people on the ground even know they have been lit, and feed weather forecasting models not just in the United States but in Europe and Asia. Without the information supplied by the polar satellites, weather forecasts everywhere would be worse. You'd be more likely to turn up at the airport and find that your flight had been canceled, or to be surprised by a wildfire, or to be hit without warning by a storm. We ran the no-satellite experiment in Galveston in 1900, says Tim Schmidt, a career NOAA researcher who has spent the last 22 years creating new and better satellite images of Earth. 10,000 people died. Kathy Sullivan's life after her astronaut career had been one ambitious science project after another. She'd spent the first 3 years as NOAA's chief scientist. From there, she'd gone on to run the Center of Science and Industry, a 320,000-square-foot museum and research center in Columbus, Ohio. After a decade of running that, she was hired in 2006 by Ohio State University to be the first director of their new Science and Math Education Center. When she returned to NOAA in 2011, a polar satellite launched in the 1990s was approaching the end of its useful life. Its replacement was late, mired in political controversy, and facing cuts to a budget it had already exceeded. She walks in the door and finds that the decisions made by a lot of other people are about to screw us all, said DJ Patil. Now it's a question of national security, because you won't be able to see the storms. A storm that went unseen, to DJ's way of thinking, belonged in the same category as a terrorist who went undetected. The Clinton administration had asked three different agencies, the Department of Defense, NASA, and NOAA, to manage the polar satellites. The collaboration hadn't gone well. The dynamic was a typical Washington sociopathic thing mixed up with a lack of leadership, said a former NOAA official. Three agencies is hard, because when you're busy or something annoys you, you can just assume or pretend that someone else will handle it. It's also hard because nobody wants to be responsible when things go badly. It's hard to control headlines and explain complicated things. Congress sends agencies very mixed signals, changes budgets, moves on to new things, speaks with many voices. Administrations in Congress don't often agree or even know about all the things the agencies are working on. Everybody blames someone else, and whoever is better at the blame game usually comes out on top. And the Department of Defense always comes out on top because it has the most resources and protective reflexes and friends. The Obama administration had broken up the marriage between NASA and the Department of Defense and handed the entire mess to NOAA. But the NOAA to which Kathy Sullivan returned had drifted further in the direction it had been heading when she'd left. While the weather forecast from inside it had gotten better and better, the political climate outside it had gotten worse and worse. Working at NOAA, or any place else in the federal government, could not be more different from working at NASA. When you were an astronaut, everyone loved you. When you told people that you worked for NASA, they were usually curious and even a bit informed. There was a reason for this, over and above the drama of the work. NASA had been encouraged, right from the start, to promote itself. NASA was allowed to tell its story to the world, Kathy said. There was a conscious need to publicize, because it was meant to restore confidence. NASA had heroes. NOAA didn't have heroes or drama. Or rather, it had drama and people who had done genuinely heroic things, but the American public never heard about any of it. It had people like Tim Schmidt, the satellite guy, whose work had saved thousands of American lives. NOAA has a hidden utility problem, said Kathy. You cannot market NOAA. You really cannot market NOAA. Over the last several decades, they not only don't get marketed, they are routinely slandered. The relationship between the people and their government troubled her. The government was the mission of an entire society. Why was the society undermining it? I'm routinely appalled by how profoundly ignorant, even highly educated people are when it comes to the structure and function of our government, she said. The sense of identity as citizen has been replaced by consumer, the idea that government should serve the citizens like a waiter or concierge, rather than in a collective good sense. Her first big task upon returning to NOAA was to fix the polar satellite, and she did it. She's unflappable with whiny politicians and lawyers, says a former NOAA official who watched Sullivan attack the problem. She was good at saying, "Stop bothering my people and let them do their job." She got a new polar satellite, launched in November 2017, back on schedule, but with a twist. She arranged it so that the problems that had bedeviled her predecessors would not trouble her successors. Of the many incredibly stupid things that a person can do on this planet, one is to build and buy a single satellite when you know you'll need more of them, she said. There was no reason that NOAA could not budget for and begin to plan the next 2, 3, or 4 satellites. There were even economies of scale for some of the complicated parts. The problem was that no one in government liked to pay now if they could pay later. Nevertheless, she somehow persuaded the relevant parties in Congress and NOAA to make a deal for multiple satellites. The ins and outs of how she'd done all this would have made for an excellent Harvard Business School case study, or a briefing memo for the new Trump administration. But that memo would never be read. The first Trump budget proposed removing the money in NOAA's budget that she'd secured for future satellites. The Trump people would never call her, but if they had, she would have offered them one simple piece of advice. You need to figure out what you want your leadership team to be intentional about, because if they aren't intentional about it, it won't happen. There's hundreds of things that will naturally happen, and then there are the things that won't. One of the things that wouldn't happen is satellites getting built on time within budget. Another was that Americans would die if you didn't work hard to figure out what was going on inside their heads. That had been her next big project. A weather-ready nation, she called it. The Joplin tornado had been the catalyst. It had various ambitions, making communities more responsive to the weather, making fishing stocks more resilient to the climate. But at its heart was the desire to better prepare Americans to face threats. Kathy had helped to install Louis Uccellini as head of the National Weather Service. He shared her passion for the problem. The meteorologists inside the Weather Service were bothered that people didn't respond as expected to their warnings. But then they were weather geeks, scientists. I can't trace exactly where or when or how the realization dawned on us that the jargon-laden bulletins were not comprehensible to users, said Kathy, or that people didn't respond to raw data. They respond to other human beings, trusted voices, or that the punchline, "What this storm may do to you," was often buried after many paragraphs of geeky weather details, or that normal humans don't understand probabilities and cannot translate a wind speed or rain rate into tangible worries about the roof coming off or being knee-deep in water. You don't particularly care what the wind speed at 500 millibars is. You want to know, what's it going to do to my house? So they set out to understand the people on the receiving end of the forecasts. It wasn't enough to farm the problem out to others. They needed people in NOAA studying the way Americans responded to warnings and to risk. NOAA was an agency staffed by hard scientists, facing a problem that cried out for psychologists and behavioral economists. The odd group, whatever the odd group is, needs to be in the room, she said. There's all sorts of inclinations not to do that. The existing powers say, leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. She wanted to start a conversation inside the agency with the understanding that they couldn't predict exactly where it might lead. It reminded her of something that had happened just after the Challenger explosion. American cities were planning to name streets and schools for the astronauts, but that had felt inadequate to her and to the astronauts' spouses. Everyone who'd been close to the astronauts wanted the meaning of their lives to be better understood through their deaths. They all had this shared joy of bringing science and technology education to lots of people, said Kathy. We asked, how do we continue that? By the end of 1986, the astronauts' families had decided to create a science education program, though of what sort they did not yet know. The spouses asked Kathy to figure it out. She started by bringing them all together to explain how uncomfortable it was going to be to create an entirely new thing when they didn't know exactly what it would be. They'd need to invite many odd groups into the room and give them the power to influence the project. I told them, it's your legacy to the crew, but to do it you need to create a network of people who feel they can shape it. The conversation really matters. Converse means exchange with. It does not mean transmit at. That's how you get new thinking. She'd heard a line once that still resonated with her. The only thing any of us can do completely on our own is to have the start of a good idea. She found all sorts of odd groups, outsiders to the space project, unknown to the astronauts' families, who might be relevant to the new mission. Teachers, museum professionals, curriculum supervisors, textbook publishers, exhibition designers, video tech types, and so on. Plus an architect. She gathered all these people in Biosphere 2 in Oracle, Arizona, to get everyone out of their ruts. Pretty quickly, the architect turned the event into a presentation of his plan for the building. Kathy and the others could see that he hadn't listened to a word anyone had said. She let him go the next day. In the end, the group discussion led to a course aimed at middle school students. There are now 52 Challenger centers around the world, and they have taught 4.5 million students. In the aftermath of the Joplin tornado, the odd group, the new kids in school, were the psychologists and behavioral economists. In 2014, Kathy helped to persuade Congress to write into law the idea that social science was part of NOAA's mission. The agency could now hire people to collect a different kind of data, data that would enable them to figure out what exactly was going on inside the minds of the American people, so that it might save their lives. The funny thing about tornadoes is that no one knows how powerful they are until they've hit something. The National Weather Service can tell you days in advance what to make of a hurricane, the strength of its winds, and the size of its storm surge, along with the likelihood of its hitting your city instead of someone else's. As you sit on your porch in New Orleans, deciding whether you should get in your car and drive to Memphis to avoid a hurricane, you have a pretty good idea what you are in for if you don't. Tornadoes aren't like that. Like the rest of the weather in the continental United States, they move from west to east, but the paths they take are random. Their force can be judged only after the fact by the damage they've done. If a hurricane is another night in a bad marriage, a tornado is a blind date. The scale for judging tornadoes after the fact runs from 0 to 5. It's called the Fujita scale. What makes it different from most scales is that it is consistently terrifying from beginning to end. An F1 tornado merely peels roof surfaces off houses and knocks cars off the road. By F2, mobile homes are being destroyed and cows are flying through the air. Kim Klockow was 7 years old, playing in a field in Naperville, Illinois, when she caught sight of her first tornado. She didn't know what she was seeing. "I saw the booby clouds," she recalled. The breast-shaped mammatus clouds that accompany big storms. "I was looking at the anvil of the storm. No one ever actually saw the tornado until it wiped out some of Plainfield, Illinois, on August 28, 1990. It had eluded radar and, wrapped in a rainstorm, had been invisible to the naked eye. The National Weather Service didn't even issue a warning until an hour after the event. Afterward, it would go down as the only F5 tornado ever recorded in the Chicago suburbs. In an F5, cars become missiles and big, well-constructed houses simply vanish. Kim's parents had driven her through Plainfield 2 days later, and she'd seen buildings she'd been inside of reduced to rubble or entirely gone, like in The Wizard of Oz. "You don't think of buildings as being dangerous," she said. "You think of buildings as being a place you were safe." That tornado had killed 29 people, injured hundreds more, and traumatized the region. The following year, as another storm approached, people were on edge. When the wind kicked up and the hail began to ricochet off the pavement, Kim was in the neighboring city of Joliet with her mother and 2-year-old sister, registering for French lessons. Her mother grabbed them and fled. As they sped toward home, Kim could see her mother watching behind them. "We were actually being chased by the storm," she recalled. "The hail sounded like bullets hitting the car. For some reason, her mother insisted that the windows remain down. Hail fell onto Kim's lap. My mother was saying the same thing over and over, but I didn't know what it was. She was saying Hail Marys." They peeled into the driveway, and her mother screamed at her, "Get into the house and get downstairs!" She'd run and hid, and came away with a feeling that it was only by luck that her house had not been blown away. "After that," said Kim, "any weather information we got, I wanted to know. This is actually the story of every meteorologist. We are a whole field of people who are child trauma cases. One hot May morning, I picked Kim Klockow up from her office at the NWS Storm Prediction Center in the National Weather Center building in Norman, Oklahoma. The center is a joint venture between the University of Oklahoma and NOAA, and about as perfectly situated as an institution can be. The south-central United States is the planet's convective sweet spot. Here, the warm air from the Gulf of Mexico collides with the cool air tumbling down over the Rocky Mountains and creates storms with more energy than nuclear bombs. Texas has twice as many tornadoes as Oklahoma, but Oklahoma has them in about a fourth the space. Kansas has about a third more tornadoes each year than Oklahoma, but Kansas is a third again bigger than Oklahoma and has a third fewer people. If you have some need or desire to witness dramatic collisions between people and weather, Oklahoma is your place. Being here during a serious tornado event is better than football, says Hank Jenkins-Smith, who runs the University of Oklahoma's National Institute for Risk and Resilience, which is as aptly cited as the Storm Prediction Center. At the top of the National Weather Center building is a skybox facing west and equipped with special blast-proof glass to watch the approaching tornadoes. Kim came to the University of Oklahoma in 2006 as a graduate student to study. Well, she hadn't been sure what she was going to study. She'd received her undergraduate degree in both meteorology and economics and, up to that point, focused on the economic impact of storms. What happens to the finances of a community hit by a tornado, for instance? The work interested her, but she also felt something was missing. I felt that classical economics wasn't really hitting on the questions that meteorologists were asking, she said. Her frustration led her first into behavioral economics, which was no more than psychology, made respectable to the sort of people who tended to think psychology was all bullshit. She set out to investigate a problem. How do people respond to risk? How might you influence that response to their benefit? If you told someone that a tornado might be headed his way in a week, he'd give you a funny look and go about his business. If you pointed out to the same person the tornado bearing down on his house, he'd die for cover. She wanted to figure out when and why complacency turned to alarm, and when and why alarm turned into action. In December 2010, she was finishing up her thesis when an advisor suggested that what she really needed to do was some field work. Go out and interview real live Americans who had responded to the news that their lives might be at risk. They said, if anything happens in 2011, we want you to do a case study, said Kim. Then Joplin happens. For complicated reasons, she set out to survey people not in Joplin, but in Alabama and Mississippi. A few weeks before the catastrophe in Missouri, tornadoes had wreaked havoc in those states, despite excellent warnings from the National Weather Service. What became known as the 2011 super outbreak spawned 360 tornadoes that killed 324 and injured thousands more. In its wake, a pair of ideas sprang up and gained traction, both inside and outside the Weather Service. The first was that the 20-minute warnings that had been issued had not given people enough time to escape. Powerful congressmen from tornado-prone states insisted that the National Weather Service needed to improve its ability to predict tornadoes, to the point where they could warn people an hour in advance. And the National Weather Service had simply nodded and accepted the challenge. Everyone in the Weather Service is so drawn to the mission of helping other people, said Kim. That's what was so crushing about 2011. Oh, I may have just spent my entire career possibly doing nothing. But Kim wondered about the wisdom of their new ambition. It's hard to talk to dead people about the decisions they made, she said. It's one of the challenges we have. But I was trying to ask what they would do if they'd had more time. She interviewed survivors in Alabama and Mississippi and came away with a startling insight. Time might be beside the point. It wasn't that people who had apparently ignored the government's alerts had been oblivious to them. They were all aware of the warnings, she said. It isn't that people wantonly disregard warnings. It's that they think it won't hit them. The paper Kim subsequently co-authored pointed out that people associate home with safety. This feeling was reinforced each and every day that nothing horrible happened inside of it. People acquired a false confidence that they would not be hit. Some inner calculation led them to believe that if it's never happened here, it never will. The people who had failed to seek shelter in the way that, say, a meteorologist thinks they should have done, had one thing in common. They lived in homes that had never been struck by a tornado. They inhabited a region prone to tornadoes. They had lived through many tornado warnings. But right up until 2011, they themselves had been spared a direct hit. They offered Kim lots of explanations for their immunity to catastrophic risk. They claimed that tornadoes never crossed the river they lived on, for instance, or that tornadoes always split as they approached their town, or that tornadoes always followed the highway, or that tornadoes never struck the old Indian burial grounds. People who lived on the west side of a big city felt more exposed than people on the east side. They believed buildings offered protection. A lot of people seemed to believe that hills did too. Where tornadoes go is totally random, Kim said. The steering winds are in the upper atmosphere. But people are not thinking of the forces of the atmosphere. They are thinking of their place on the ground. Psychologists have long known that people see patterns where none exist. Londoners during the Blitz felt they'd deduce the targets of German bombers by where the bombs had fallen, when the bombs had been dropped randomly over the city. Americans routinely made the same mistake with the weather. Soon we were driving west together, Kim Klockow and I. A few minutes after leaving the Storm Prediction Center, we passed from Norman into Moore, and from one wan row of shopping malls and car dealerships to another. Here was another curious example of man's attitude toward the things that might kill him, and another illustration of Kim's point. The people in Norman think that tornadoes don't hit them. The people in Moore believe they are especially prone to being hit by tornadoes. Moore's sense of doom dates back to May 3, 1999, when a tornado crossed the freeway and cut through the town. It was a mile wide and generated wind speeds of 302 miles per hour, the highest ever recorded on Earth. It killed 36 people, including a woman who had sheltered exactly as experts had instructed, by lying in a bathtub and covering herself with a mattress. A car crashed through her roof and landed on her. On May 20, 2013, another F5 tornado struck Moore and killed 24 people, including 7 children in a school, after an interior wall collapsed on them. Between those two events, Moore had been hit by 2 F4 tornadoes and been dealt glancing blows by several small ones. By 2013, its reputation as a magnet for tornadoes was sealed. The perception of risk of the people in Moore is about twice that of people living in Norman, said Kim. Moore is the only town in Oklahoma to have adopted building codes to defend itself against the wind. It has even devised a scheme that allows worried parents to bus their children to schools that have storm shelters. The people in Norman are less likely to start preparing during a tornado watch than the people in Moore, said Kim. The people in Norman think that Moore is more likely to be hit than Norman, and this might be the most educated population about tornado risk in the world. Hundreds of meteorologists live in Norman. The road to the weather of the future is straight and hot. It leads after an hour or so to the city of El Reno. You can still see this one, said Kim, in the trees. 11 days after the 2013 Moore tornado, there had been another spin-up right here. Within minutes, what became known as the El Reno tornado was 2.6 miles wide, the widest tornado ever seen, and headed for Oklahoma City. Tornadoes leave scars that are visible from space when they are big enough, Kim says. The second idea that gained traction after the 2011 tornadoes was that people simply failed to appreciate what happened when a tornado hit a mobile home, or a car, or really anything that wasn't bolted to the ground. If the warnings highlighted the potential destruction, the thinking went, people might pay them more attention. Impact-based warnings, the new warnings were called, though the differences between them and the old warnings were fairly subtle. The Weather Service did not generally communicate directly with the public. It issued warnings to local emergency managers and the TV meteorologists, who then passed on what they'd been told. But the Weather Service now encouraged the weather media to help people to imagine what might happen if they did not seek shelter. The idea was that the people just don't know how bad it is, said Kim. If they knew how bad it is, they'd take action. Complete destruction of entire neighborhoods is likely. Many well-built homes and businesses will be completely swept from their foundation. Debris will block most roadways. Mass devastation is highly likely, making the area unrecognizable to survivors. And so on. The market for weather news in Oklahoma is fiercely competitive. The local TV weather anchors already felt pressure to make the reality more interesting than it was. They glom onto the worst-case scenario days before we can have any confidence, says Kim. A government agency does not have an incentive to hype. Private companies have an incentive to hype. The problem when you hype is that you reduce confidence in all weather forecasts because no one knows the source of the information. About 30 minutes before the El Reno tornado reached Oklahoma City, a TV weatherman named Mike Morgan told his viewers that anyone who wasn't underground was doomed. Most people had no underground place to go. The soil in Oklahoma is a sandy clay floating on a high water table. The place on the planet where people most desperately need to dig a hole to hide happens also to be a place in which it is expensive to dig. Though a car might be the single worst place to be in a tornado, tens of thousands of Oklahomans fled by car. Instantly, the southbound lanes of the interstate became a parking lot. The El Reno tornado bore down on what amounted to a miles-long traffic jam. And then it lifted. By sheer luck, the El Reno tornado killed only 8 people, most of whom had been fleeing it. What didn't happen did not get nearly as much attention as it deserved, in Kim's view. If it hadn't lifted, if it had continued on its path, the estimates of the fatalities would have been Katrina level. It's the worst catastrophe that almost happened. In the most tornado-savvy population in the world. It was really jarring. El Reno had been her turning point. It struck me. How could we think we could help people without understanding people, she said. The way we have approached things is by learning about the threat. We've ignored the people being threatened. She thought that impact-based warnings were intellectually dishonest. How could you warn about the impact of a storm whose force you would only be able to discern after the fact? She was also pretty sure that people knew what a tornado could do to them. The people in Alabama and Mississippi knew. So do the people in Joplin. Their problem, as she saw it, was a different sort of failure of the imagination. People could not imagine that all those tornadoes that had wound up hitting other people could instead have hit them. The sirens had become fake news. The government needed to find ways to make the news feel real. A few months later, she moved to Washington, D.C., on a congressional fellowship, and went to work for a senator who sat on the committee that oversaw the Commerce Department. I'm gunning for something inside NOAA, she said. You have to have people on the inside to make the change. In late 2014, her ambition collided with Kathy Sullivan's. And NOAA hired Kim Clockow to be its first and only social scientist. She became the odd group in the room. She'd spent 3 years in the job. She'd hoped to create a social science unit on the top of the agency that could both direct a research program and spread what it learned through the Weather Service. The problem with our science is that it is new, she said, and we don't know how to make people not die. We need data on what led a person to do what they did. We need observations of humans responding to weather information. She'd made some progress. She'd also been frustrated. Barry Myers, AccuWeather's CEO, turned up at a meeting and said that I shouldn't be doing what I was doing, she said, because it's marketing. But it's not marketing, it's saving lives. The question became, what can we do in this space without interfering with the profits of AccuWeather? And then Trump was elected. She'd planned to return to Oklahoma anyway, but now she did it with a sense that she might be better off starting small rather than trying to change the entire Weather Service from the top. The inspiration came from Dr. Sullivan. She advised me to rely on small bets to make significant organizational change, not to try to force big, sudden change from the top. It was May 2017. And Kim Clockow had been back in an office at the University of Oklahoma only a few weeks when the meteorologists in the Storm Prediction Center forecast a storm in the Texas Panhandle. She hopped into a car with another meteorologist and went west to where the weather came from. When I was in D.C., I lost my sense of direction, she said. In D.C., this is not material knowledge. She'd found the storm in Texas and then turned around and followed it from behind into Oklahoma. The little girl, once terrified by the storm that was chasing her, was now a woman chasing a storm. In Oklahoma, as often happened, the storm met an atmosphere more favorable to it, and it grew. I saw it, she said. It was a beast. She'd arrived just outside of Elk City when she heard the weather service issue its tornado warning, and so she'd stopped. You don't chase into a city, she said. You don't chase to see death and destruction. At length, she and I drive the hot, flat road past the Cherokee Trading Post and Boot Outlet and arrive in Elk City. Elk City is where we'd been heading all along. Lonnie Reisenhoover had been managing emergencies in Beckham County in one way or another for 40 years. Before he became emergency manager for the entire county, he'd worked as a fireman in Elk City, where he was born and raised. His great-grandfather had moved there in the late 19th century, before Oklahoma was even a state, and the family had remained ever since. There were only about 25,000 people in the whole of Beckham County, about half of those in Elk City, and Lonnie knew most of them. He'd seen all the storms, too, but the county had been lucky that way. Most of the tornadoes are real rural, he said. Well, we had a tornado when Joe's chicken coop just blowed away. Tornado. The one thing the storms had in common was the hysteria about them generated by the TV news stations in Oklahoma City. If there's an icicle hanging off the corner of the house, it's, hey, there's an icicle hanging off the corner of the house, we're going to go live with it. Icicle. The information Lonnie took seriously came directly from the National Weather Service. If the Weather Service had a TV channel, everyone would just watch that. Every morning he woke up and checked NWS Chat, the Weather Service's tool for communicating with local emergency managers. The morning of May 16, 2017 had a slightly different feel to it than usual, though Lonnie didn't immediately put his finger on why. They said a storm was coming from the panhandle, but storms were always coming from the panhandle. There was no tornado warning. But a tornado wasn't like a winter storm. The models hadn't gotten to the point where they could predict a tornado before it happened, in the way they could bigger weather systems. The Weather Service could only issue a tornado warning after it had seen the tornado, either with its radar or one of its spotters. What I noticed, said Lonnie, was that they'd changed some of the language they used. They said tornado emergency. It used to be just a tornado warning. He left the chat more worried than usual. The storm might be a problem, he thought. The Elk City Fire Department had a few tornado spotters, but they just sat at fixed points. The city had blind spots. The western part of Beckham County, we didn't have many storm spotters, Lonnie said, and I am basically a one-man shop, so I can do everything I need to do in my vehicle. His truck had so much gear in it that you didn't want to ask what it all was for fear that the explanations would never end. From his truck, he could measure the wind speed, see the radar, and stay in touch with the Weather Service, even if his phone lost service. He got into his truck and drove west to find a place from which he could see as much of the Earth's surface as possible. If you were just passing through, you'd think Beckham County was essentially flat. Brownish-yellow wheat fields and pasture land as far as the eye can see. In his 40 years of storm spotting, Lonnie had come to know every slight undulation in the terrain. In 20 minutes, he was parked on some of the highest ground in the county, facing southwest. When the meteorologists from the Storm Prediction Center go out to chase storms, they chase them from behind to make sure they aren't overtaken by the tornado. Lonnie just sat there, waiting for the tornado to come at him. My wife used to go with me, he said. Now she won't. She says, you scare me. Then he saw it. Or maybe he didn't. I seen a funnel, he said, but I wasn't going to start calling it a tornado until I start seeing grass or something else it's picking up. Whatever he was seeing vanished after maybe a minute. He couldn't tell how fast it might be moving toward him, or how far away it was. He didn't want to trigger a warning unnecessarily. If he did that, people might not believe the next one. At the same time, what he was hearing just then from the National Weather Service was not normal. They hadn't seen the tornado, but they were acting almost as if they had. I kept getting information, he said. They were feeding me a lot of information, and I thought, this is really, really going to be bad. He was utterly exposed. Alone, out in a massive storm that might or might not be